Artificial intelligence is a real problem for us, as far as we are told. It's going to take all of our jobs. And if you are in computer science and graduating right now, or maybe have been in computer science, people are finding a difficult time entering the workforce or finding jobs right now because of artificial intelligence. Talk about that with us and some other issues with AI is CNN tech contributor Lisa Itachico with us on KMOX. Lisa, we appreciate your time. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thank you for being with us. And it, you know, just reading the story that you had written for CNN about how difficult it is for people who are in computer science, and for years we have been told this is a great thing to get into. Well, apparently it is now becoming difficult to get into that line of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of what we're seeing now in some of the data out there on unemployment right now, and especially for entry-level roles in computer science. The demand is shrinking a little bit. And I think this is something that there's a lot of factors, right? I think maybe AI is part of it. I think we have two things that are kind of happening at the same time here, which is that companies are looking to downsize a bit. And also at the same time, companies are starting to use AI in bigger ways in the workplace. And I think we're seeing that a lot in the tech space, because there's a lot of these coding tools out there that can write some code for you or assist you in writing code. Now, that doesn't mean that these tools are going to entirely replace people, as some of the people we spoke to, the students in the story, which, you know, some of them, even though they've been having a rough time, are actually pretty optimistic. You know, the code always has to be checked by a human. There are certain things that need to be maintained by a human that AI can't do. But I do think it changes the job at a time when these students are already breaking into a really competitive market.
Is it a certain segment of IT or computer science that AI is threatening the most? Because I know it's such a broad field. It's like the medical field. You could be an orthopedic surgeon, you know, or right. You could be a brain surgeon, totally different things. Is there a part of IT that AI is affecting the most?
It seems like it's affecting software engineers more so than IT. So IT is usually maintaining equipment and things like that. The person that you call at work when your computer is not working or you can't get something to connect, right? And I'm sure AI will affect those roles at some point too. But I think where we're seeing the biggest impact right now is in software engineering. So people who write code for a living, whether that's back end or front end code. Back end is, you know, the code that supports the website or application that you're using. And then the front end is what controls how a website or an app looks. So like the design element and things like that. So I think that's where we're seeing a lot of the impact right now. And it does, as you mentioned, like it's a broad field. It does vary from time to time. I think the people that I spoke with seem to use it most for just kind of, doing some of the menial tasks that they might not want to do, or for learning about a new language for the first time. So there's a lot of different languages in computer science. And, you know, one thing that AI has been helpful for is helping developers kind of switch between them and learn the basics of a language that they might not be super familiar with.
So I know that AI can be a very useful tool in a lot of different fields, a lot of different areas. Is it possible to get to a sweet spot here where it does help people with busy work, but also doesn't take a lot of jobs away from everybody else? Because if that's what starts to happen, then we are in serious trouble.
Yeah, I think that's the optimistic case for sure. This idea that this technology will help you do your job and it'll kind of automate the parts that you don't want to do and the things that take up your day but really aren't a part of like the core role that you're here to do. That's the optimistic case for sure, is that AI will do that for you and will let you do more of the things that you get fulfillment or career growth out of, right? The things that you need to be doing that AI can't do or can't be automated. But I do think that while that is certainly a possibility, and I do think that's part of it, the thing that worries me and that I think a lot of people have been talking about is some of those menial tasks are what entry-level people do right now. And if you aren't assigning those things to entry-level people, what are entry-level folks doing? And how do you have an entry-level workforce that you can then train up and upskill to eventually become a senior person and become a leader if you're replacing some of that work with AI? So I think That's the question that everyone's trying to answer right now, I think, is what does the role of an entry-level worker look like across different fields if we use AI to automate some of those tasks?
Because I think a lot of us don't really have a whole lot of faith in artificial intelligence companies in reeling it in or putting guardrails up for themselves. What is the role of governments around the world, what they are going to have to do to try to make sure it does not get out of hand in that way?
That's a certainly a big question. And I think with AI in general, like aside from just this, future of work and what it means for jobs, I think in general, there's been this question of how do we regulate AI? What is the appropriate level of regulation? Because it's not just about the threat that it could have to jobs in the future, but also, there's a lot of like safety questions around AI as well. These systems are still computer systems. They're still very flawed in some ways, even though they can do incredible things. They also make a lot of mistakes and they can be kind of irresponsible sometimes, right? Because they're not people. So I think there's this kind of this struggle to be careful and be safe with how these systems are deployed and what they're used for, while also moving fast and moving quickly. Because another thing that's a really big priority in the government right now is making sure that the US is a leader in AI and that we're not putting up too many guardrails that'll slow down development and deployment of AI, especially as, China is, has a really big growing academic field and does a lot of AI research. And, there's this concern about the US falling behind in the AI race. So I think that's a big question and something that I think a lot of lawmakers and regulators are trying to answer right now, but I think it'll be some time before we truly find that sweet spot.
Switching over to ChatGPT, and ChatGPT's parent company, OpenAI, is planning, or at least says it is planning, to launch parental controls. Now, this comes on the heels of just some tragic stories of young people interacting with ChatGPT and then taking their own lives. And the parents have filed lawsuits in multiple cases saying that the ChatGPT advised the teenagers on their suicides or contributed to their suicides. Can you set the table a little bit on what happened, perhaps in these cases, and how ChatGPT helps to curb this trend?
So there have been a couple of really tragic cases, as you mentioned. One of them was recent. The parents of a 16-year-old named Adam Rain filed a lawsuit against OpenAI, alleging that ChatGPT advised on the teenager on his suicide. There was also a separate case, not involving ChatGPT, but another app called Character AI. A Florida mom sued that company last year, alleging that her son died by suicide after developing an inappropriate relationship with chatbots on that platform. So, what's been happening here is that people are seemingly either, consulting AI chatbots on these really, really difficult mental health subject matters, or they're forming these bonds with AI in a way that makes it difficult to kind of blur the line between reality and fantasy. And it's not just teenagers. There's also been reports around adults using ChatGPT and kind of falling into a delusion and alienating themselves from loved ones because they're believing these things that ChatGPT are telling them, and it's causing them to kind of break from reality. It's really, really unbelievable situations here. And so what OpenAI is doing now is they're within the next month planning to roll out parental controls that will include things like the option for parents to link their account with their teen's account, manage certain features and choose to disable them, like memory and chat history, which could potentially help with sometimes with these longer conversations. If ChatGPT can draw on old chats and remember what you said, it makes ChatGPT sound a little more personal and a little more human-like. So that's probably one of the reasons why a parent might want to disable that. And then also receive notifications when the system detects that their teen might be in a moment of distress when interacting with ChatGPT.
So again, when I asked the question earlier about trusting these companies to do the right thing, put up the right guardrails, should we trust them that these parental controls will be good enough and will be sufficient to stop any of this?
That's a difficult question because I think part of the problem here is that not only necessarily that maybe these companies are not putting enough protections in, but in some cases I truly think they don't expect these things to happen. And I think that's the question that needs to be answered is how do these companies kind of foresee what these risks are going to be before they happen? Because I don't think that a company like OpenAI predicted that people would form social relationships or seek life advice from ChatGPT. And if they did, they certainly should have taken that into account. But it's definitely something that I think that's kind of the issue with technology in general here sometimes is that you don't often know what the negative side effects are until it's too late. And this is something that Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has also kind of mentioned in the past when he's testified about this at a Senate subcommittee on AI regulation earlier this year. He was asked, is enough being done to protect children? And he even said at the time that this idea of social relationships and life advice from ChatGPT is something that really needs to be kept an eye on.
And it is kind of interesting, too, because with OpenAI, like how can they anticipate how people would interact with it? There's also no stasis with AI and ChatGPT because it's constantly learning and responding and interacting. So ChatGPT is never stagnant. It's not staying the same. It seems that like if I were a parent, it would be up to me not to trust ChatGPT to put in guardrails and to just stay on top of, my kid and their interactions and how what they're telling ChatGPT because the technology itself is always changing. Like OpenAI, it has to be reacting. They're not getting ahead of anything.
I think that's right in a sense that it is always changing and people are always using it in different ways that are unexpected that can't be predicted. And I do think that part of the answering this question and solving this problem has to be around education as well, especially if the kids are adopting this technology faster than the parents are. We know that young people tend to adopt technology more quickly and embrace it more quickly, and especially this generation of kids growing up with AI, they're definitely, I'm sure they're going to embrace it more than their parents are, right? So how do we educate people in the dangers and the risks and help, in addition to these companies and holding them accountable, because they certainly do have to be accountable and be part of this, but and they should be maybe part of helping with that education component. But I think that that's a really good question.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think parents are wondering what they can do in the meantime if they're not as savvy with this or any other sort of technology. Like, how do they, for the time being, before controls are in place, before all of these safeguards hopefully are implemented, like what can they do in the meantime?
I think so. There are things that you can do. There are apps out there that help you kind of set parental controls in terms of like monitoring app usage. There's also settings in your phone, both on iPhone and Android, that can help restrict certain apps or set time limits on certain apps. And then I also think just having a conversation with your children ab about the technology and reiterating to them that, hey, this isn't a person, this isn't real, this is what it's okay to use it for, this is what it's not okay to use it for, here's how you should use it. I think those are the things that parents and teachers and other adults could be doing in the meantime.
Lisa Itachico, CNN tech contributor, we appreciate you. Thank you for talking with us about this today.
Of course, thank you again so much for having me.
That is Lisa Itachico. Again, she works for CNN, and we're still trying to navigate artificial intelligence, and we will continue to do that as best we can. It's Amy Marks Kors and Chris Ranji. National Guard has been in Washington, D.C. for weeks now, and apparently it is, in fact, going to Chicago. We will discuss that and why it's happening. Also, Danny Cox, former Cardinal, he's going to be on the show today. The 1985 team is being celebrated this year, 40th anniversary of the 85 National League champion. Danny Cox joins us at 10:30. It's Chris and Amy on KMOX.
Well, last week we talked quite a bit about President Trump deploying the National Guard to Washington, D.C., and then rumors were he was going to deploy the National Guard to Chicago. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker addressed the issue, said we would love help from the president in other areas. If law enforcement wants to come on in and help and work with the Illinois police, we'd love that. But we don't want the military walking the streets in Chicago. Well, last week, Vice President J.D. Vance said that the administration's policy was based solely on voluntary requests and invitations from state and local officials. He said, no, we're not going to force the National Guard on anybody. This will be by invitation. But then the president contradicted what Vance had said about the voluntary requests for the National Guard. And President Trump said he does have the right to send National Guard troops to Chicago. And he said, quote, if the governor of Illinois would call me up, I would love to do it. Now, we're going to do it anyway. We have a right to do it, and that includes Baltimore. So,
yeah,
it sounds voluntary, not voluntary, but we have a right to do it. And, of course, just, again, Washington, D.C. is a unique situation because it's a federal city.
Right.
It's different than all of these other cities, so he could call the National Guard to Washington, D.C. It seems that it was his prerogative to do so, but it's different now that he is spreading out into the states.
It's very difficult to, and I'm sorry, because I know there are people who think this is a terrific idea and he should do this because crime is out of control. Relatively speaking, it's not. Crime in Chicago was far, far worse in the 90s. Far worse in the 90s. It's not even close to what it is now. And in a lot of these other cities, it's kind of the same deal. I would take it more seriously if he was sending National Guard troops to the neighborhoods where crime is actually occurring, but they're not. They're doing it in visible places. They're doing it in tourist attractions where there is no crime. In Washington, D.C., there you see National Guard troops standing outside of Le Diplomat, which is like a really upscale restaurant that people hang out in. It's not a place where crime happens. These people, these guard members are not going to be showing up in Inglewood. They're not going to be showing up in Austin. They're not going to be going to some of the neighborhoods that do actually have crime in Chicago. They're going to be in tourist spots where people can see them. And all they're going to do is get in the way. That's just what's going to happen here. So none of this is actually affecting anything. And in fact, there are restaurants in D.C. that have been reporting since the guard has shown up that they've seen fewer people even come to the restaurants. And they're having a difficult time. They like to say that, well, crime is down now because the guard. Well, nobody's going. That's the problem. Nobody is going to these areas in D.C. because the National Guard is there. So it's not improving the situation. It actually seems to be making it worse. So I can't take it seriously. And I know there are people who are going to argue for it, and you can make the case for it. Great. I'd love to hear it. Yes, there is and should be something done about crime, generally speaking. As long as there's poverty, we're never going to get rid of crime altogether. So we need to just understand that. But I don't think this is a real serious effort to do something about crime in the United States.
Well, to your point, the National Review, one of the editors of the National
Review. Very conservative outlet.
Wrote a piece and said basically, okay, what we're seeing the National Guard do is generally make themselves visible in front of public spaces, maybe drinking coffee or taking photos, and doing what you said. They're not going to areas where there are the highest crime rates. They're going to the most visible areas where tourists
are. It's eyewash.
Yes. But he said it's also important to note, which is actually what J.B. Pritzker also noted, is the National Guard, they're just following orders. Probably a lot of them don't want to be there. Don't be
rude
to them. Don't be cruel to them.
They don't know what they're doing or why they're there.
And the National Review pointed out, he said, okay, listen, I know the National Guard is there, but they're not the Gestapo. They're a well-trained, lawful military force, and they're basically being deployed by the president to kind of stand around in public places for political points. That's what it is. It's political points. And like I said, J.B. Pritzker also pointed out, hey, the National Guard's not coming in saying, yeah, we're here. They're just kind of standing around taking pictures with people. I think it's also important to note that when you are looking at crime in a city, I would say there's a reason why I have more conservative views. And, you know, when it comes to crime versus some Democratic approaches, I'm not a huge fan of the mayor of Chicago. He discontinued the ShotSpotter system, which can help police respond quickly to shootings in the areas where there are the most shootings. And there were, what was it, 54 shootings in Chicago over the holiday weekend. So that's not great. So how do you address crime and have real conversations about that? But if you're looking at Chicago,
by the way, the guard's not going to those areas where those shootings happened.
Right, which is what we said. And so if you're looking at Chicago and you're looking at crime and shootings, you can say, well, you know, how they're handling it in Chicago is different than I'd want it handled in my city or how we handle it in Tulsa or whatever it is. But policy that you disagree with isn't illegal. It's just policy. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm not a fan of the mayor of Chicago, and I wasn't a fan of, Tashara Jones here, the mayor of St. Louis. She's the mayor, and he's the mayor, and he was voted in, and those are the policies he was voted in for. So if things aren't going well in Chicago, well, that's kind of the democratic process. If things are going well in Chicago, that's also the democratic process, unless there is a criminal negligence in a job. You can't remove a person who was democratically elected, and you can't send in the troops because you don't like that guy's policies and say, well, I'm going to strongman my way.
Well, I will tell you this. I lived in the city almost 15 years. I never felt unsafe. Never once. It's people who live there do not feel unsafe. I feel like there are more people with opinions on that city who don't live there. Oh, it's a war zone. It's dangerous. You'll die if you walk down a street. You don't live there. I did. I live there, and I go there a lot now, and I can tell you it is not the war zone that some of these people are trying to tell you it is. It just isn't. They're wrong. Danny Cox, member of the 1985 National League champion St. Louis Cardinals. The 40th reunion of that team is happening this week. Danny Cox is on the show next on 104.1 FM KMOX.
Now, the John Rooney Conversation on KMOX, sponsored by Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and if you're a Missourian, we're for you.
And that's a winner! The Cardinals go to the series! They beat the Dodgers 7-5. It's a beautiful scene to observe as the Cardinals pound McGee and each other, give high fives, low fives, kisses and hugs, and they've won the game 7-5, and the 85 Cards are in the World Series.
Oh, baby, 40 years it's been. 40 years. That was my first favorite baseball team ever. I mean, 1982 happened, but I was pretty young. I barely remember it. 1985, I do remember. Heck of a year it was. And the 40th anniversary, the reunion, is happening on Friday, and it is happening here in St. Louis. And there are going to be over 20 former players and coaches from the 1985 team, including Ozzie Smith, Willie McGee, Vince Coleman, John Tudor, Tom Herr, and our guy, Danny Cox, who is with us now on 104.1 FM KMOX. Danny, it's good to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. How about yourself?
We are doing great. And like I said, that was my first favorite team because I was just old enough to know what was going on. And it's been 40 years. How well do you remember that game that we just heard Jack Buck make that call of you going to the series?
Well, every time I hear that, puts a smile on my face, gives me goosebumps. And, we did it in L.A. too, which was even better feeling. You know, just beating them on the road. Something about Dodger Blues not as good as Cardinal Red.
Yeah, like I remember that Jack Clark home run, which is the thing that I think most mm-hmm. people really remember from that series. When that sure. happened, what was going on in your mind?
That's probably about the highest I jumped as a white boy, you know. I got up there pretty high when that ball went over the fence. And, went up to what was funny about it was, still early in the game, I think the eighth inning, and we dogpiled at the plate. Everybody went up there, was high-fiving Jack, crossing the dish, and, just something about it was a feeling that, hey, we're going to win this, man. We're going to win this because, we went back to St. Louis down 2-0 and then came back and won 4 straight to go to the series.
So even when you were down by 2, you hadn't won a game yet, you felt pretty confident? The team just felt that they knew they were going to fight back?
Yeah, you know, Amy, I think the big thing about that is we've played a lot of games up to that point already. We won the division. We had 101 wins. And, you know, throughout the course of the season, you have your highs and your lows. You're winning streaks. You're losing streaks. And knowing it's the best of seven and you're only down two, somebody's still got to win four. So you just keep playing your game. And we had good pitching. We had great defense. And we just kept playing some whitey ball, and fortunately put it all together and, you know, won four in a row to go to the series. And, it was just it's a great memory. And, you know, one thing about the Cardinals, they love their alumni, and they treat us no other places. There's no other place like St. Louis Cardinals fans, and what the Cardinals do for the alumni is just fantastic.
Well, and as we mentioned, 40 years, so it's a reunion. So many players, coaches will be in town. Ozzie Smith, Willie McGee, Vince Coleman, John Tudor. Do you guys have is this like going to be great to all see each other, or is there a 1985 text thread where you guys are talking a lot all the time throughout the year?
Well, we do talk, you know, and I see Ozzie at various golf charity functions, and TP, I'm going to be doing something with him Friday after the game. And John Tudor, I talk to him. I play in a couple of golf tournaments that he puts on. So, you know, we keep in touch. We do this. But it's different when you finally get to see your buddies again, shake hands, give them a hug. You know, it's always good to see that smile, because what we have are good memories. And it's, you know, always fun to see your teammates again.
Danny Cox from the 1985 National League champion Cardinals with us on KMOX. We're talking about the clinching of the World Series spot, you know, getting to the series. Is there something along the way from the 85 season that does spark a memory for you? Something that you do think about outside of just, you know, getting to the World Series, which is huge?
You know, I think probably about the biggest thing was just the how upbeat it was throughout the whole season. And the Mets were playing great. I think at one time we had won like 14 out of 15 games, and they had won 13 out of 15, and they still lost a spot behind us. So if you're playing that kind of baseball and still losing, you know, ground on the team that's in front of you, it's just a feeling, you know. Come to St. Louis, and it was always alive. You know, they had the airplane flying around. You know, Mets are pond scum and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if you guys remember it.
Oh, but yeah.
It was. The stadium was alive. You know, there was nothing was pumped in. No sound was pumped in to get everybody fired up. They came there fired up. As a matter of fact, you know, when we showed up to the ballpark, it was the stadium was already alive, and it's a yeah, that gets in your blood, that gets in your system, and you know, it makes you want to play good for your fans.
You know, it's funny you bring up the Mets, because when I went away to college, I went to a school halfway up the state in Illinois, and a lot of kids I went to school with were from Chicago, so a lot of Cubs fans. And as soon as they would find out I was a Cardinals fan, they go, "Oh, Cardinals," you know. and you know, I didn't have a feeling about the Cubs. It was the Mets. The Mets were the team that I hated. And then later in life, I hated the Braves, right? It was the Mets. That was the team that in the mid-80s, nobody liked. It really wasn't the Cubs.
Well, that was, you know, as a player, that was our biggest rivalry. I think the rivalry between the Cubs and the Cardinals is throughout the ages of the fans, you know, bragging rights and so forth. But during that time frame for the Cardinals, We didn't really care much for the Mets, and I'm sure the feeling was mutual, you know, because two good teams wanting to reach the same goal, and we had some pretty good games that we played against one another there at their place and our place. So that made it exciting. It was real challenging, because they had a real good ball club, and they proved it the following season by, you know, winning the '86 World Series.
So let me ask you this. Did players hate that team as much as fans did?
Probably more.
Okay.
Because they got all the ink, you know, being from New York, they still got all the ink, and we're in first place, you know, and it was kind of like, man, what's this all about? You know, give her respect where it is and give it its due, but it was always they were the better team. But, you know, I understand that. That's New York media.
You know, it's so you mentioned Whitey Ball, and I think the 80s is such an interesting time for baseball. And, you know, the Cardinals focused on speed so much. How much did what role did AstroTurf play in the way when it started spreading everywhere in all these ballparks in the 80s, and now teams are focusing on speed and not necessarily trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark? How much did that kind of change the game too in the 80s?
Well, it did for the Cardinals, that's for sure. I think we probably stole over 300 bases back-to-back years, and that was something that hadn't been accomplished then, and I don't think it's been surpassed since. But that's the kind of ball we played. We didn't have home run hitters. We had good contact hitters, line drive hitters, and get on base, steal a, you know, get on base, steal a base, ground ball, move them to third, sack fly, we got to run. Now you got to score two to beat us. We do that again. Now you got to score three. And that was just our game, and that's how we played it. And I think the Mets, they had more pop than we did. They had more home run hitters, but they had a few guys that could steal the bases too. So that's what's made them good. But I think, you know, there's all types and different ways to win the game of baseball, and I think we utilized them pretty good offensively and defensively.
As a player, and now we are 40 years removed from the event, how long did it take you to get over the Don Denkinger call?
I don't think you ever really do, but you just accept it because that's just the way it is, you know. And I guess about the only time it bugs me is when I see a guy from Kansas City with a World Series ring on. But outside of that, it's, hey, there's, if there was instant replay back then, I'm sure a lot of things would have been different, you know, for a lot of things. But that's what it was. And, you know, we all saw it. And you got to live with it. That's just part of the gig and part of the game and part of what it's all about. And, you know, you just try to get over it and keep playing and hopefully keep playing as long as you can and enjoy having the ability to do it and having somebody like you that wants to keep on their team, because I just grew up playing baseball and was fortunate enough to be with the Cardinals. And it's kind of a thing that it never goes away from you. You just, like you said, it's been 40 years. Can't do anything like that anymore, but I sure enjoyed my time when I could.
Do you feel like every year you maybe have even more time for reflection on just how special those days were? I mean, it's something being a pitcher, winning the World Series for the St. Louis Cardinals. So few people get to experience that.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty neat. And I think St. Louis recognizes it. And they always have reunions for whatever team it is and always have events going on down at the ballpark to celebrate their past history. And fortunately, I'm still here to enjoy it and be a part of it. And it's something that, you know, as you get older, it becomes fun, and your family gets to go with you now and enjoy it. They enjoy all that kind of stuff. And it's just a real nice feeling that to know that you're appreciated for what you did, and people enjoy how you played the game of baseball and had a chance to watch you, and we give it 100%. And, you know, I think they saw that, they feel it, they lived it, and they respect it. And they're just, their way of saying thank you is by having something at the ballpark to show their appreciation.
For the Friday night game, there is a mystery bobblehead, a triple bobblehead. They're one of two that that people could end up with. 20,000 fans, 16 and over, they're going to get one of these two, the first 20,000 that come through. You're on one of them with John Tudor and Joaquin Andujar. Have you seen it, and how do you feel about it?
Well, I haven't physically seen it, but I've seen a picture of it. But what a great honor, huh? I mean, that's pretty cool for me to be on there with John and Joaquin. And I think between the three of us as starting pitchers, we won 60 games. So that was pretty impressive there, I thought. I think John had 21 and Joaquin had 21. I had 18. So it was to be on that, and, you know, 40 years later, and get to share a bobblehead with couple of great pitchers and a couple of great friends, and it's just something, you know, kind of puts a smile in your heart.
It's got a great mustache.
It's a terrific mustache.
It's a really nice mustache.
Is the bobblehead mustache better than the real one?
Bobblehead, huh? You approve, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're looking at it now.
You hear that center position looking ahead? Man, and the mustache is in its full glory.
All right. Well, I'm just glad they didn't have my head looking up over my shoulder.
Flying out of the ballpark. That's not nice.
That would be such
Come on,
a
man.
Mean
you just
bobblehead.
You just won 18 games that year. Why would they do that?
You got to have some fun with it. You know, I mean,
that is actually a great idea.
Yeah, you know, the ribbing's going to come here. You know, once we all get together, it's going to be nothing but laughs and digs and all kinds of good stuff. So looking forward to it.
Of everybody on that team, who is the most prolific crap talker?
I don't know. John Tudor didn't talk crap. He backed it all up. You know, he was always coming in a little bit negative. I don't have nothing today. I don't have nothing today. You know, eight innings later, he gave up one hit. You know, we're like, yeah, right. You know, it was that kind of stuff all throughout. But was blessed to be on a team that had won the World Series in 82. So there were still players from that. So when I came in, they already had that you know, demeanor, that feeling that, you know, we've done it, we can do it again. And so when I came up, you know, sure, I was a rookie, but I learned quick about the right way to do things, the Cardinal way, how we're going to approach things. And all the vets back then kept you in line. And, you know, not only that, but they taught you a lot, you know, about certain players and umpires and so forth, the things that they experienced and pass it on to you so you knew prior, which is, you know, a big deal. It's a big help.
Danny Cox, we're looking forward to seeing you on Friday, where the 40-year anniversary reunion of the 1985 Cardinals team, the National League Championship team, will be at Busch Stadium. There is a pregame ceremony happening at 6:30. A lot of members of the team are going to be there. There are still tickets available at cardinals.com, and you're going to want to get out to that. But we appreciate you, Danny Cox. Great to talk to you again. Thank you for being with us today, and we'll see you Friday.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Amy. You both have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.
Former Cardinals pitcher Danny Cox. Again, that 85 team, very, very special to me. As I said, my first favorite baseball team. I loved that season. Amy Markscores, Chris Ranji with you. And don't forget, that game, tickets available still. Cardinals.com. That is happening on Friday.
Okay, I thought of a great idea. I was inspired by Danny Cox, our last guest, former Cardinals pitcher. You know, he said he was grateful that on his bobblehead, they didn't have him looking up over his shoulder. They should totally do troll bobblehead nights at Cardinals. Like at a Cardinals game at Busch Stadium, they should have a Brad Lidge bobblehead night where it's just Brad Lidge looking up over his shoulder. Or they could have the crying Brad Marchand bobblehead night.
Yeah, they're not going to like that. What they could do, do something
like that. That's a great idea.
I think
the troll bobblehead night. Who every single Blues fan would want a crying Brad Marchand, where he's slumped over on the bench and he's crying, and that's the bobblehead that they give out that night. Matt, you agree? You're nodding.
I agree.
It's a great bobblehead,
and I want you to be able to fill up the Brad Marchand bobblehead full of water, and it sort of just like seeps tears.
Like the dolls that cry and go potty. Yeah.
I think here's a better idea. I think they should do a Yadier.
Guess what? Ron has a better idea.
They do. My ideas are better. They should do a Yadi bobblehead with the ball stuck to his chest protector.
Okay, that's
they should do one of
that's
those.
Fine, that is not a better.
That's
idea.
A good one.
The
I think
trolling bobblehead is so much better.
People would much rather have a Yadi bobblehead where he just got his hands on his side, like, how did this ball get stuck to my chest protector? How did that happen?
I want a Brad Lidge bobblehead of him looking straight up and behind him. I think it's a great idea. Megan Eberhardt with the St. Louis Cardinals. Call me.
Cardinals ruined Brad Lidge for a bit.
They did.
Because he gave up a walk-off in the World Series, too.
Oh, but not enough to have a bobblehead.
Correct. Nobody wants a Bradlidge bobblehead.
I think it's great.
Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk to Mike Rothschild, conspiracy theory journalist. We love this dude. He is the author of The Storm Is Upon Us and Jewish Space Lasers. There was a Trump death hoax over the weekend where it spread and people thought the president was dead. And we'll talk about why people create death hoaxes. Mike Rothschild next on KMOX.